We can walk down the stairs now, most of us. What a great blessing that is. And it's those simple things that we forget. Now take a person who is completely handicapped, a person who is not able to do that, a person without limbs, a person without eyes. What would such a person give to be able to enjoy a moment, a simple moment of our looking at this beautiful shrine, the Kudum, you know? But we don't appreciate this. We don't appreciate the fact that I have the freedom to see, I have the freedom to hear, I have the freedom to think, I have the freedom to sit when I want, I have the freedom to lie down when I want. And we imagine that our happiness lies in another house, another car, another, you know, thing, another whatever we can get and so forth. And that makes us unhappy. And we keep working towards what would actually, we think we are searching for happiness, but what we keep trying to do is getting more reasons to be unhappy, because the dissatisfaction is so much more magnified than the contentment of the simplicity. And so you know, one of the wonderful things that you can find in the life story of the great yogis and the great masters is that of the immense joy of contentment and simplicity. That's priceless. How many of us, no matter how many books we've read, how many practices we've done, how many, how much ever capable we may be in life, how many of us in today's world can really boast the fact of having had carefree laughter and contentment? The joy of being able to hold a simple apple and relish it and eat it as an apple must be eaten. We pick up an apple and think, I wish it was an orange. I like papayas better. Things like that. And so it is, I think, that sustaining of such a habit that we have, that we are losing the simplicity of human happiness in simple things. And so, yes, outwardly, so much, really, you look at the world and you think, never has there been, not in the Buddhist, alone in the Buddhist world, but wherever you look, cleverer people, wiser people, learned people. There's just immense, you know, in, even just in our environment here, so many learned people. Never has there been such a big group of so many learned people, or capable, or wealthier, or powerful, busier. But in the midst of all that, what we have, I think what we have begun to lose is the simple joys of serenity that comes with simple simplicity. And so when we as practitioners become very learned and we hear a lot and we think a lot and we analyze a lot, there's the wisdom aspect that's very valuable that should and does come out of it. But on the other hand, it, I think also, if not careful, goes into a movement of procurement, of getting things, of having things. So sometimes, especially when now our Sangha and Sangha members more and more go into retreat and are doing practices in retreat, it's really, really nice. But on the other hand, it's also a little strange that when they go into retreat, they go into retreat with so much planning. What should I do? How many sessions should I have? Should I do this one? Should I practice this thing? Should I practice in that? It'd be nice if you just sort of went into retreat. And every day you woke up fresh and spontaneous with a lot of compassion and devotion in your mind. And the simplicity of just having your mala, that could be just doing the recitations of the mantras and being quiet. But it doesn't become, you know, that kind of simple thing is, I don't know. People don't appreciate that very much these days. And then instead, what happens is, you know, going into retreat or doing practices becomes like a, let's go, you know, climb Mount Everest kind of a thing. So base one, we are going to do this. Base camp two, we are going to do that. Today in base camp three, we are going to climb 700 feet, you know, and then plant a flag and come out of retreat. So when the great teachers and great beings, they went into retreat, you know, you don't hear them about how many sessions. It's seamless. And what do you do there? Rinpoche used to say, you do two things. The mala wears off, you know, you just wear out the mala, and the cushion wears off. That's what you do. And that's how it should be, that you're there, and you've heard, and you're really blessed and fortunate in having all the teachings. And so all of those teachings, your mind reflects upon. It comes to you. Within your heart, within your own mind, each page of the text turns naturally. It's almost like within your mind. In your mental ears, you hear the sound and the words of the teachings. And within your deep awareness and your mind, the meaning evokes, sort of resounds within your own mind. And you stay with that. And space sort of filled with mantras, recitations, whatever it is. But the whole being of the meditator at that moment has to be seeped in the sweetness, in the fragrance of all what you have heard thus far. And in this moment, which teaching and what practice? That's making everything so very predictable and agenda-driven, very formatted, without doing so. Probably the only frame, sort of the structure that you could frame is, I will sit, I will be quiet, distancing myself from crowd and all the different kinds of busyness of life, mundane activities. I will free my mind from the hopes and fears of daily life. Besides that, as the sun arises, your mind permeates with the meaning, and the, as I said, the sound of the Dharma resounds in your mind, and the meaning permeates through your mind, and you sit with that. And you let your mind really accustom itself, orient itself with the Dharma. That's what retreat is. You retreat from all of that which did not allow you to really meet with the nature of your true being. And so you now, being in retreat, give yourself the opportunity to now remain with that. As much as possible, keeping that moment untainted by the different habitual patterns, the chaos and the busyness of samsaric life. Now, if you don't do that, and instead sort of, I'm going to practice this and do this and finish that number and so forth. Yes, that's a very disciplined approach. But then the same patterns of habitual tendencies of self-control, self-attachment, agendas, planning, hope and fear, everything comes into it. So when you are doing retreat, I think what would be very, very helpful is to lessen every habitual, samsaric habit, habitual way of looking at things, and settling yourself with Dharma. Don't climb Mount Everest. No. Just be in retreat. So keep that in mind. Otherwise, everyone's doing very well. Of course, now you're all going to go into retreat very soon. So that, I think, is whatever amount of time that you're able to devote to practice, it'd be wonderful if you could lessen the whole drama of practice, of being a practitioner, and found a little bit of simple spontaneity, you know, inspired by all the great teachers. Guru Rinpoche, beginning with Guru Rinpoche, Shakyamuni himself, and emulating their approach rather than, you know, it's the same thing, I think, as children, when children read books on pirates, there comes a time when you want to be a pirate, and then you go out to the shop and you buy that patch over here and a plastic knife and, you know, sort of feel the piratiness within you, if there's such a word. Now, if in the retreat, if you're trying to do that, you know, just sort of copying, imitating, and it's all hearsay. He does and she does and they did and that did, and also this is how it should be. So people have all of these convoluted ideas of what it means to be in retreat. And so it has to be this way. So you pick up tips here and there. When you hear somebody come out of retreat, you know, oh, how was your retreat? How did you do your retreat? So if that person says things like, well, I sat in retreat in meditation, in a meditation box, what you hear immediately is, I need a meditation box, you know. Now it can't be a bed, it can't be a chair, it can't be. And then you have to write all these long, lengthy, may I sit on a chair? By all means, hang yourself from the tree, you know, if you wish. Just practice the Dharma, which is, you know, whatever it is. So, then you hear somebody say something like, I ate only twice a day. So then they get into the mind, in retreat, I have to eat twice a day. Should it be at 10 and 4? But then I take diabetic pills or whatever it is, another medication. And so what can I then move around that situation? So you pick up those tips, you know. What does a pirate wear? So it has to be the folded, I don't know what it is called, cap. So then everybody goes around buying a folded felt cap. Yeah. Pirate must have. Do all pirates have a patch?
No.
There must have been quite pirates who could look with two eyes, I guess, without a patch. You know, it is possible. But no, you know, now you dress up as a pirate, you have to come with that patch. So the retreatants think, oh, then I have to grow a beard. So we emphasize so much of this kind of, all these little things that we have picked up here and there. Some of them are very useful advices or instructions. They can be very good and supportive of your practice, but the life force of the practice is your mind, and the mind must be settled. And how it settles, no one can do that better than your own self. So freeing yourself from mundane outlook, from samsaric outlook, and then retreating yourself into a completely new approach where there is nothing other than you and your basic good mind, and letting that basic mind develop its awareness, giving it momentum, giving it breathing space. And then what enhances it? It could be a guru yoga practice. It could be prostrations another time. It could be something else another time. And being flexible with that. Of course, when you go into retreat, you do have a certain commitment to a practice. And that's very fine. But on the other hand, with the commitment of the practice, whatever that you are completing, a much more permeating, vaster, spacious awareness that remains steady with the inherent nature, and then allowing it to becoming more strong, so that out of that comes out a more aware, good, genuinely more, a practitioner who is more aware of the nature, freer from the insecurities that so seduces us in our daily lives in samsara. Must happen. Mundane life, the way we try to control everything, brings about the consequence or the resultant state of tremendous insecurity. The more you try to control, of course, it can't be controlled. So it ignites and aggravates the insecurity. And when the insecurity is very strong, then you're not happy. And if you're not happy, all the negativities come out of that, whether it is jealousy, whether it is grasping, whether it is anger at yourself or the others, or the arrogance, and everything comes out of it. And the insecurity is because instead of appreciating the moon, you think you need to control everything. So some semblance of human life is such that, yes, we do have to have some idea of what we're going to do next, of how we're going to, where we're going to do, some planning or something must be there. But as practitioners, not being so dominated by that, that there is no room for free-flowing spontaneity to not be there at all, then it's I think, really instills the unsettledness, the insecurity, and so forth. So practice well, especially as we grow older. There's no time to lose. Practice well. Be in retreat. But the relationship that you have with your aging and practice and wish to deepen the practice, especially in retreat, must not be so caught up in fear and panic and insecurity, but a sense of, you know, subtle joyfulness. So instead of scaling a high mountain, just sort of being at the base of the mountain and enjoying how nice and high it is, leave the climbing to a lot of people who have nothing better to do.